Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Childless cat ladies are ruining America. That's according to Republican nominee for Vice President J.D. Vance. His full quote to Tucker Carlson on Fox was that the U.S. is being run by Democrats, corporate oligarchs, and a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made, so they want to make the rest of the country miserable too. This would not be the last time that the Ohio senator would weigh the woman's worth based on her willingness or ability to bear children. He also publicly suggested that parents should get more votes than childless individuals, and he argued that parents that don't have children should pay higher taxes. Many of the criticisms of being childless have been directed at Vance's political rival, the Democratic nominee for president, Kamala Harris. In September, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders took a swipe at Harris's family life, saying the presidential candidate doesn't have anything to keep her humble. The governor said during that rally with former President Donald Trump that her children are a permanent reminder of what's important and they keep me humble. So now we know that being childless in America, in the GOP's eyes, makes you less than. Somehow, a woman who is not a mother isn't a real woman at all. Do you agree with that, or do you argue with that? We're talking about today on The Source, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined by Peggy Huffington. Her book is called Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother. And Peggy, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you make of these political attacks on women who have not had children?
Well, a lot. It's been an interesting
summer. Unload for us. Unpack.
So I guess one of my initial reactions when Vance's comments reemerged this summer is how revealing it is. The way he talks about what it means to have children and what a family should look like. So in that quote that you referenced, he goes on to list a number of Democratic lawmakers who he sort of puts into this category of miserable childless cat ladies. And he includes people like Pete Buttigieg, who did go on to have two children with his husband, Chasten, and who has talked about how long and painful that adoption journey was. So that's someone who very much wanted to have children. And then, of course, Vance also includes Kamala Harris in that list, who, you know, quite well known, is a loving stepmother to her husband's two children. His ex-wife has been very clear that she's, you know, she considers Harris a co-parent. And so when Vance includes people like that, it reveals that when he says that he's pro-family, or when he says that people should have children, he's talking about something very specific, like a heterosexual biological unit. And I would add, a biological unit that is not created through IVF, which is something that he seems to oppose. So he's really talking about this, I'm making scare quotes here, natural kind of family formation. That's what he's valuing.
The IVF issue, we'll get more into that, but
sure.
Some of his MAGA supporters were going so far as to carry little plastic jars that said the Vance's family, full family plan, and it had some, you know, opaque liquid in there. It was supposed to be pretending as if it was a semen sample jar, which is rather bizarre or weird, I think is the word that I'm looking for.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it is extremely strange and quite disturbing, I have to say, but it also connects back to a fairly long history. One of the things that I research and write about in my book is that in the years following the American Revolution, so the early 19th century, there's this emergence of what historians have called the Republican mother, and that's small r Republican, like as in the new American Republic. And this was an ideal that that a woman should be contributing to this new American nation through her reproductive capacity, that it was men were supposed to fight for their country and women were supposed to have children and raise them to be good American citizens. That was their duty as citizens. And so I think, you know, with that history, we can draw a fairly straight line between Vance sort of suggesting that in order to be a good American citizen, in order to really serve your country, you need to serve it reproductively, all the way back to, you know, the early 19th century.
But I can't stop thinking about the connection that there would be to a Handmaid's Tale sort of narrative here, that they, as rights are eroded, as motherhood is exalted, and as people who cannot have children or choose not to have children are demonized, then are we just tiptoeing closer to a Gilead?
Oh, gosh. I hope not. But I think you're absolutely right to point out that there is a connection between falling birth rates and falling fertility in the United States, which is a trend that has, it's really over the last 200 years, but has sort of intensified in the last few decades, that there is a connection between falling fertility and renewed efforts to restrict access to abortion, to restrict access to contraception, and also to exalt motherhood. And again, you know, as a historian, I see resonances with the past. In the 19th century, the American fertility also fell really dramatically. And that was the same period when that exalting of the Republican mother sort of emerged as the ideal way for women to participate in American civic life was reproductively.
Yeah, so we had a brutal civil war where so much of the population, the male population, was wiped out.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so these anxieties about falling births and women's reproductive choices in particular, and efforts to sort of restrict women's choices, these are connected, and they have been in the past as well.
Well, what about the subtle inferences that they want the right people to have children?
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly it, right? That there's a clear nativist bent in what, you know, politicians on the right are talking about. They claim to be concerned about, you know, falling population. They claim to be concerned about the future of the American workforce, about the future of the American tax base. And yet they are, you know, advocating for restricting immigration and instead suggesting that the way these things will be solved is by women having more children, who, I might point out, you know, 16 years from now may go get a summer job. So I think in the dissonance between these two policies, they're sort of telling on themselves that this really isn't about, you know, just ensuring that there are enough workers paying taxes. They are concerned about women's reproductive choices and about the future ethnic and racial composition of the country. And again, I mean, I keep going back to the 19th century. That nativism is there as well.
We're going to get into that. We're going to get into all the different aspects that you have in your fascinating book. It's called Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother. Having a discussion with the author, Peggy Heffington. She is an assistant senior instructional professor and associate director of undergraduate studies at the University of Chicago, teaches and writes on feminism, women's movements, and motherhood in America and in Europe. If you got questions or comments, give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues after a 1 minute break. Stay with us. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother. We're joined by the author, Peggy Heffington. And have you noticed out there that there seems to be hostility in the Republican Party against women who have not had children? Either they chose not to, or they couldn't have children. One reason or another, they are childless. And apparently that's a big deal to J.D. Vance. So if you've got a question or a comment, you want to weigh in on that, do you feel like it's an unfair allegation, or you're being put in a spot there, that this is not something that he should be commenting on, or he should be, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So we do have a question about, like, how do we describe, Peggy, how do we describe women who do not have children? What is the best way to sum that up in a word?
Oh, this is fascinating. So this was something I grappled with in writing my book, because, of course, we don't really have terms that aren't loaded. Childless seems to, you know, it was certainly levied as an insult by J.D. Vance, though I'm not sure it landed that way, but it implies a lack, right? There is also the term child-free, which emerged in the 1970s as sort of a reclamation of an identity. It was people who really wanted to celebrate this as a choice. But I think child-free also doesn't encompass all of the ways that people might not have children. Someone who experienced infertility and was unable to likely wouldn't identify as child-free. The title of my book was a little bit cheeky because it is just simply Without Children, which I find is a factual way of describing someone without children. And in some ways, it was my protest to not having neutral language to describe, you know, what is becoming an increasingly common reproductive reality for a lot of women.
What do you think it meant when, like Taylor Swift, when she endorsed Kamala Harris, she signed her endorsement a childless cat lady?
Well, I found the reaction to Vance's comments. So, of course, as you mentioned, the comments were originally from 2021, and they reemerged this summer, and almost immediately, people. The insult didn't land. People were celebrating. You know, it was an identity that people wanted to own. Almost immediately, you had childless cat ladies for Kamala T-shirts being made. You had, you know, women on the internet saying, like, heck yeah, we're childless cat ladies. Like, that's an identity I want to own. And I think Taylor signing her endorsement of Harris and Waltz as a childless cat lady is just sort of like the cherry on top of that, that almost what would have been an insult is suddenly something that young people are willing to claim. And I suspect that has to do with changing norms, but it also suggests like a certain comfort with being childless as an identity that can be celebrated.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. And we have Cleo. Cleo, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to say that being childless or having children should not be an issue for the political party to, like J.D. Vance talking about childless women and whatnot. I have not actually had a child, but I raised three stepchildren, and I feel like anybody who makes a choice one way or the other should not be set aside and criticized or anything. So they need to keep the government out of our personal lives, and let's talk about issues that matter in the world.
Cleo, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. So do you see this as a divisiveness, Peggy, that trying to divide the population, particularly women?
Absolutely. I mean, and this, again, this goes back to, you know, two centuries, to the early 19th century, when as fertility was starting to fall, and as motherhood was becoming idealized, there was similar, at the same time, increasing rhetoric about how bad it was to not have kids, and how that should be read as a character flaw and as a, you know, a shirking of one's civic duties. And I see in this an effort to divide women, precisely as you said, to make it very clear to them that they have two options. One is to be a good citizen and a good woman, and the other is to be a poor citizen and a poor woman. And which one are you going to choose? And so I do think it's been used as a wedge to make clear to all women that there is only one correct reproductive choice. And you know, to Cleo's point, I think it's been really interesting in the wake of the reemergence of these comments that even people on the political right, maybe not as far right, but on the political right, sort of were encouraging Vance to back off of that kind of criticism.
Yeah, because he doubled down.
Yeah, he did. He apologized to cats, but not to women. But there was some sort of sense that, you know, there are a lot of stepmothers in this country. There are a lot of stepmothers in Pennsylvania, and they vote, and that there are, the reality is that the American family has a sort of diverse appearance, and there are many blended families, and there are many people who have, like Cleo, raised children who didn't give birth to them, and that sort of fetishizing this really, you know, specific biological way of becoming a parent really isn't representative of the way people are making families.
I'm gonna go to another caller. We have Juan, and Juan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to comment that how come the pro-life and pro-choice people and their conversation has never mentioned that in the late 50s and early 60s and up to the 70s, there was the going on that the people that were advising us not to have any children because if we have an increase in population, there will not be enough food to feed them.
All right, Juan, thank you for the call. So we had that argument in the 70s. The Population Bomb was a popular book at the time, predicting that we would have too many people and we would live in a world like Charlton Heston and Soylent Green.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's quite startling, as Juan points out, that within, you know, 50, 70 years, we have gone from the primary anxiety being too many people. And there was a moment in the 1960s when that was something that environmentalists on the left and national security concerned people on the right would have agreed on, that population was a concern, too many people was a concern. You know, 50, 70 years later, we've gone to the opposite extreme of, you know, being concerned about too few people.
So,
it's fascinating.
Now, what Vance is saying and others who are, you know, mimicking him, this seems to be happening at the same time that we're living in post-Dobbs America, and we have many women, that's a primary concern when they go to vote, and it's bad for Republicans. Is some of this rhetoric, is that an answer to the question about, you know, how should I vote if I am a woman?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is quite telling that this conversation is coming after Dobbs, and it's also coming after we're 2 years past Dobbs, where it's become much more difficult in half the country to have abortions, and yet what we're seeing is that the number of abortions has gone up over the past 2 years since Dobbs, and also the number of babies born in this country has fallen. So the intended effect that you know, people who opposed Roe v. Wade and wanted to see it overturned, it really hasn't had that intended effect of increasing increasing births in this country. And so I think you can see a little bit of frustration in this rhetoric about, well, you know, now we've tried these legal measures and it didn't work. So now, you know, there's sort of this pro-family propaganda rhetoric is sort of coming through.
Let's go to another caller, Edward. And Edward, you're on the air.
Hey, folks, this is a great topic and very important. I wanted to see if we could, at least for a moment, try to get above the partisan framework of how all this is playing out, you know, nationally as a conversation. And here, as humans that respect one another, go just above that for a moment and recognize that the replacement rate, the birth rate in this country among citizens, I don't care what ethnicity, just citizens, is not up to replace. And there seems to be this tacit assumption by some who say that's not a problem, because immigrants, I guess, and migrants will always be there. But what if they're not? What if their countries improve and they stop coming here? Is that not a distinct possibility? What happens when we can't rely on migration to keep our population from crashing?
All right, Edward, thank you for that. So can you respond to that, Peggy Heffington?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, my first caveat is that I'm a historian, not an economist, and so I have to say that I talk about the past, not the future. However, I think, you know, there is certainly policymakers and economists and demographers are concerned about the fact that in many developed countries, the United States, Europe, East Asia, birth rates have been below replacement. In the United States, we fell below replacement in the early 1970s. So there is sort of this fact that in developed countries, the fertility is not going to replace the population, and there will be decline in the absence of immigration.
Well, let me just ask that this said, to put a finer point on it. Yeah. So if the concern is that we need to address the population issue, I don't know if shaming is the best solution for that.
Yes. I don't know that shaming is the best solution for that. And I also don't know what the best solution for that is. Because
public policies.
Countries have tried a variety of policies. So from the sort of very pronatalist, say Viktor Orban's Hungary, which has taken as its motto reproduction, not immigration. There, they have sort of instituted all kinds of policies for Hungarian people to increase their family size. Hungary's birth rate is lower than ours. We're around 1.7, they're around 1.4, 1.5. On the other end of things, countries like France, like Scandinavia, have instituted policies that are really supportive of families, generous parental leave, free or low-cost daycare, healthcare, tax credits for people who have children. And in those countries, fertility is, between 1.6 to 1.8, still below replacement. And so I think that there is a question of, is this going to be a problem, maybe on a, decades in the future, maybe even centuries in the future? Because economists and demographers do expect the global population to be increasing over the next 100 years by several billion people, which does seem like enough to keep us going for a while. But there's the question of whether this is a problem, and that is certainly something that people are debating. And then there's the question of what are the solutions? And it seems to me that sort of forcing mechanisms and incentives have only a marginal impact on voluntary birth rates. And then I think that raises a question for us as a society of, how are we going to sort of ensure the future of our economies, the future of our nations, without, while also allowing people to make reproductive choices that work for their lives?
So you write about this in the book, and we're going to get to this, but a lot of young people are looking at the world, the planet, the political environment that we're in, and they don't know if it would be a responsible thing to bring a child into this existence. And so if you're talking about Hungary and Viktor Orban, that's a dictatorship. That's not, you think about, should I bring a child into this world? There's also climate change, all sorts of we're probably living in an oligarchy right now. We just don't know it, don't realize it, not sure what the future looks like, and people, it impacts us. So is having a family, is giving birth an act of hope? And where is that hope? And if we give people hope about the future and that we're going to bring children into a beautiful world, then maybe that is the solution. So we're going to take a break here. Our phone lines are open. I got Kimberly on the waiting list. And Kimberly, we'll get you next. And anyone else wants to weigh in on this, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book is Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother. We're joined by the author, Peggy Heffington. You can call in. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. I got an email. The email is thesource@tpr.org. Good morning. Didn't have biological children. I have the BRCA1 gene mutation. I've undergone harsh chemotherapy and multiple surgeries. I couldn't forgive myself if I handed this down to my children because males can be carriers as well and potentially have their lives affected, their reproductive system. I have and currently do enjoy being a stepmother. Why are the women being attacked like this? And where has the mentality of other women agreeing with this come from, being so aggressive? And so thank you so much, Bonnie, for that email. We appreciate that. So can I get your reaction to Bonnie's email, Peggy?
Sure. The writer Sheila Hetty, several years ago, wrote that there was what she called a civil war between mothers and non-mothers. And, you know, I went into the research for my book sort of assuming that that was true, assuming that the lives of mothers and non-mothers were sort of so different and so incompatible that of course there would be strife between them. But to Bonnie's question, what I learned as I researched the book was that actually those divisions between mothers and non-mothers were constructed, and they were sort of constructed for us very intentionally by a society that wanted to make it clear that having children was the only right choice. And so if you look not even that far into the past, you see mothers and non-mothers sort of supporting each other, helping raise each other's children in the way Bonnie describes, and sort of all being involved in raising the next generation. And so for me, it was looking at the history and starting to understand that what I felt was a real divide in the present was actually something that was sort of intentionally communicated to women as an effort to make them make particular reproductive choices. It was really helpful in sort of understanding why there is that feeling of strife between mothers and non-mothers today.
Let's go to caller Kimberly. And Kimberly, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment that it seems rather derogatory and insulting to insist that a woman's value is only placed if she has children, but that same value is not levied against the men. I don't know where the Republican Party thinks this is going to help them, but to denigrate half the population, or at least women in particular, doesn't make sense to me.
All right, Kimberly, thank you for that call and that comment. So does this still apply also to men, Peggy?
Well, one thing I will say is that much has been made about Kamala Harris's reproductive status, and that if she were president, she would not have children. She would not be the first president who did not have children. In fact, she would be the fifth. Most notably, I think our nation's first president, George Washington, did not have biological children. He was a stepfather. And far from that being a problem for late,
so he's a stepfather of the country.
Americans. Yes, exactly. They actually thought it was a benefit that they had just thrown off a king, and here was a guy who had no biological heirs. So he wasn't going to try and take over and make it, you know, the reign of the Washington, the House of Washington. And so I think it's quite interesting then to now see that J.D. Vance is saying, well, the only way that you could care for the future of the country is by having biological children who are citizens, when our nation's first president, actually a point in his favor was the fact that he didn't have biological children. So I guess this is a roundabout way of saying that this standard has really never applied to men.
Let's go to another caller, Chris. And I think Chris has got Alan? Alan, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thanks for taking my call. No, the only comment I have is that, like many people, I think they want to wait to have children until they are, you know, with a solid companion, you know, and because there are a lot of children that have experienced like multiple divorces, and I think they have just become a little bit more cautious.
All right. Alan, thank you for that. So, Peggy, people are they waiting longer to have children if they are having children? And is that a factor?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So starting in about the early 1970s and intensifying in the 21st century, age at first marriage has been rising, and age at first birth has been rising. And that tends to mean that people have fewer children overall. It's not that they just delay and then have the same number of children. it's that they, you know, if they have them, they have fewer. So absolutely, that's a factor of people just sort of delaying until they find the right partner, maybe because, you know, they saw our parents' generation have, you know, more than half of marriages end in divorce. But maybe it is also because they're pursuing graduate degrees or prioritizing their career or trying to buy a home before they have children. So for whatever reason, people are delaying marriage and delaying childbearing, which means that instead of, you know, say having three or four, they're having one or two.
All right, now let's go to Chris on the phones. And Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you. And it's a great conversation. I've wondered for some time why, you know, what Vance would think of childless men, what he does think of childless men, and why do men have the reproductive freedom to have a vasectomy? It seems to me if women's reproductive rights are restricted, men's should be too.
All right, Chris, thank you for that. It's interesting. There have been multiple studies that show that there is a rise in vasectomies in the United States, about 20% rise in men who have never had children, who are under the who are in their 20s, getting vasectomies since the Dobbs decision. And so, Peggy Heffington, have you heard about that? And why do you think that is?
That's absolutely fascinating. I didn't know that statistic. I mean, I don't know that I have a great answer for Chris other than to say that this is an expectation that has long been placed. I mean, and by long, I mean centuries, that has long fallen on women, and it has long been significantly more societally acceptable for a man to remain unmarried, for a man to not have children than women. I mean, just think about the terms we use, that a bachelor pad has sort of positive connotations, right? Whereas a spinster or a childless cat lady, you're describing the same, you know, reproductive and marital situation, but for men, it's sort of coded as a positive thing, and for women, it's coded as a negative thing. And so I do think that, you know, there just has long been a you know, inconsistent application of this expectation based on gender.
How is being childless, a woman who's not a mother, how is that reflected in our fiction?
Mm.
I mean, denigrate it in our fiction? What do we say about that in our storytelling?
Well, I think one thing I will point out is that the term spinster, which of course, you know, going back to the great novels of the Victorian era, Jane Austen novels, like the worst thing that could happen is that you become a spinster, right? The term spinster originally only described a woman who earned her living by spinning wool into yarn, which meant that she was economically independent and therefore didn't have to get married. And so the idea that an economically independent woman who you know, provided for herself became this incredibly negative thing, and in fact, like the worst thing that you could possibly become, I think tells us a lot about how the you know, in literature and in society, the expectation that a woman's highest calling is to be married and is to have children.
Let's go to Kat on the phones. And Kat, you're on the air.
Hey, David, this is a very important conversation. I've been wanting you to have this one.
A cat lady, yes.
yeah. Well, listen, my son and almost all of his friends, believe that it's irresponsible to bring children into a dying planet. Mother Earth is dying. They know it. They blame us, which is correct, but they feel it's irresponsible. And the only way to change that is to heal the planet.
All right, Kat, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So when you talk about that in the book, because the planet is one of the chapters, you have the chapters broken up in different reasons that people offer. I mean, do you find that is a widespread concern?
Yeah, a recent survey of 10,000 young people globally found that 6 in 10 of them were afraid to or had concerns about having children because of the environmental future of the planet. So I think absolutely this is something that's on their minds. It's on the minds of my students. It's something that I hear from them. And it's a shift from environmental concerns that people expressed in the 1960s and 1970s, which were about the damage that a person who becomes a polluter was going to do to the planet. Now, I think young people are not thinking about like the carbon footprint of the baby or how much pollution they're going to produce, but instead they're thinking about the environment as something that is already damaged, that we know the future of the planet is going to be worse than the present, and that therefore it becomes like an ethical problem to bring a child into a world that you know is going to be worse. And I think this goes back to what you were talking about hope, about needing to do the work to secure a future so that people feel able to want to bring children into it.
Right. So we don't want a future like Cormac McCarthy's The Road, where the living envy the dead. We right. want a future that is glorious. And I think that is possible. I haven't really bought into the doomerism of climate change. I think that there's a lot of energy and smart people working on trying to prevent less being thrown into a post-apocalyptic nightmare. So let's not go there yet. There's still a lot of life on this planet, and we can always figure our way out of things. So let's take another break. We're going to come back, continue talking about Without Children, the long history of not being a mother. When I come back, I want to ask you about Ann Lohman, who she was, why do we need to remember her? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, jawboning with Peggy Huffington about her book, Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother. A lot of great history that you don't had a lot of stuff to learn in this book. Who was Ann Lohman?
So Ann Lohman was better known as Madame Restel, which was a sort of a pseudonym that she adopted for her practice. She was an abortion provider who practiced in New York City from about the 1840s until her death in 1878. And she is fascinating because her career spans a shifting legal landscape in the United States for abortion. So when she begins offering abortions, abortions are not illegal in New York and virtually nowhere else in the country. New York at that time only prohibited surgical abortions, which were done after about the fourth month, after quickening, which is when the woman starts feeling the fetus move. So she's offering a legal service of early term abortions through herbal means. But over the course of the almost four decades that she practiced, abortion becomes increasingly illegal in the United States. So as I said, at the beginning of the 19th century, it's not illegal anywhere in the country. By the early 1870s, it's illegal in every state. And then in 1873 becomes illegal against federal law. And so Restel is actually put on trial in the 1840s because she's accused of having performed an abortion too late. And she's acquitted because there is no evidence that she actually did it after the woman felt the fetus move. And so it was found that her services were in fact legal.
So it's interesting in your history, you lay out that birth control, abortions, things like this, they have been practiced and available to humankind since basically the beginning of civilization. There have been efforts they're not as reliable as the O-pill, but, you know, there were things out there that were being used.
Yeah, absolutely. This was something that was really fun for me because I'm a modern historian, but I found that people, when I told them about the book, they started asking, well, you know, I thought the birth control pill was invented in the 1950s. Like, how could you be talking about people controlling their reproduction before that? And so that sent me digging into gynecological treatises from ancient Rome and ancient Greece. And I found all of these incredibly ingenious ways that
women were— They were busy.
Yeah, they were. And they were really actively attempting to control their fertility. And, you know, in some cases, you know, using things like lemon, which has citric acid, which is actually a spermicide. In the Middle Ages in Germany, medical treatises record hundreds of herbs that they say will end a pregnancy, and it's something like a quarter to a third of them would probably work. So they were onto stuff. They were actively trying to control their fertility.
But the idea, though, that this is a modern issue, and it actually was only modern about it as it's being. Being bandied about and being legalized, and men are involved in trying to regulate it because back in the day, as they say, this was really this stuff that was passed from mother to daughter or, you know, in sewing circles.
Yeah, absolutely. This was considered to be more or less women's business, that, you know, likely their male partners didn't want to know. In 1812, in fact, the Massachusetts Supreme Court found that common law had nothing to say at all about abortion because it was a woman's business. It had, you know, it wasn't a matter of law at all. But then quite quickly, over the course of the 19th century, you have the emergence of medicine as a male-dominated and increasingly professionalized practice that starts to sort of intervene in health matters. The American Medical Association is founded in the 1850s, and one of the platforms that it gets on is about opposing abortion. One of the reasons it was in opposition was in part to force you know, non-professionally trained doctors like Madame Restelle out of business, right? It's a professionalizing organization. They're professionalizing medicine, and people like Madame Restelle are—
So it's bad for business.
Are bad for business, exactly. But so you have this emergence of men into reproductive care and into birth and into things like abortion and contraception, which had always been women's business.
Let me ask you about Anthony Comstock, because we're getting kind of right in that era as well, towards the late 1800s, and the passage of the Comstock Act, and how it is now being, it's being called a zombie law. If you want something scary for Halloween, the zombie law of the Comstock Act is a great suggestion because they're bringing it back. Even to Supreme Court Justice Alito talked about it during oral arguments recently. So tell us about the Comstock Act.
Sure. Anthony Comstock was one of the most prominent social reformers of the late 19th century. He opposed all kinds of vices, but one of the ones that really got him going was contraception and abortion, which he thought sort of separated the act of sex from the act of reproduction, and sort of he really thought it was going to bring the end of civilization. So he made a lot of influential friends and ultimately got the Comstock Act passed in 1873, which prohibited sending anything that would prevent a pregnancy or cause an abortion through the mail.
Including information,
absolutely. And very briefly, it actually prevented the sending of medical textbooks until the Congress decided to fix that. It effectively made it illegal to distribute, you know, herbs that might cause an abortion or you know, that might prevent a pregnancy.
And now they're talking about applying the Comstock Act towards medical abortion pills in the United States post-ops.
Yes, because the Comstock Act was never repealed. It was sort of chipped away at and made obsolete by Supreme Court cases in the 1960s and 1970s that made access to contraception and abortion legal. But the act itself was never repealed. It remains on the books. And in recent years, you do, as you said, see this reemergence of the Comstock Act as something that is on the books, absolutely, and that could potentially, as you said, prevent the distribution of abortion causing pills nationwide, regardless of state law.
Let's go to a caller, Irene. Irene, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I have a two-part question.
Okay.
I'm not of childbearing age anymore, but if I was, I would actually be afraid to get pregnant. I would be afraid of dying, whether prenatally or at the time of birth. I think that Republican legislatures really don't value the lives of women. And the other part of my question is, if we really are going to have birth control eliminated, I don't think I would have sex either. I would be too afraid month after month wondering if I'm pregnant and there's a chance I could die.
Irene, thank you for the call. So that lays out a grim reality for a lot of women. Peggy, how does that tie into what you're writing about without children?
Well, so there's historical precedent for the exact kind of anxiety and increased efforts that women put into not getting pregnant when abortion becomes restricted or when contraception becomes restricted. So in the 1960s in Romania, abortion was made illegal with very harsh consequences for the women as an effort to boost population. And initially, for a couple of years, births do sort of bump up as women probably can't figure out how to, you know, how to end a pregnancy. But then within 5 years, the birth rate falls below where it was in the first place. And of course, maternal deaths also increase. And that suggests that women are probably becoming more cautious about having sex, about getting pregnant in the first place, and also are willing to, at great legal and bodily risk, pursue abortions anyway. We see throughout history that these policies, not only do they not have the intended effect of actually increasing births, but that they can often have this sort of unintended consequence of actually making people much more cautious about getting pregnant in the first place.
So, Peggy, your book's been out for a little while. What's your reaction been?
One of the things that surprised me the most was the positive reaction I have gotten from mothers in particular. Because of the Civil War that I talked about, that I had worried that the book would be a shot across the bow to women with children. But in fact, I've been very surprised and heartened and maybe also dismayed to find mothers reacting so strongly to it, because one of the points the book tries to make is that all of the reasons why parenting is very hard in this country, why it is economically hard, why is it's hard in terms of support systems, in terms of time, in terms of sort of navigating a society that is not, you know, particularly supportive of families, that those are the exact reasons people give when they say they're not having children. And so I think a lot of mothers felt very seen in reading my book, in reading about, you know, the pressures that our society has placed on people, and how difficult it has become to parent in our society. So that has been, like I said, heartening in terms of we're all in this together, but also dismaying because we're all in this together.
Yeah, and I would just say that anyone who wonders why we're having this problem, if it is a problem, but women who decided not to have children, just look at the maternal mortality numbers that we have in the state of Texas and ask, why aren't we doing more, everything possible, to make having birth, childbirth in Texas as healthy as possible? We're not doing that. But Peggy Heffington, thank you so much for joining us today. Really enjoyed talking to you, author of Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
Is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.